Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the LSE. Welcome to the LSE Festival on Power and Politics. This is a festival about how we use power and politics to shape our world. My name is Brian Roberts. I'm a philosopher of science and director of the Center for Philosophy of Natural and Social Sciences at the LSE. I'm very pleased to welcome both the in-person and the online audiences to this event. So there is a podcast being made of this event. So you're all invited to ask questions. There's going to be a question period, but be aware that you're being recorded. And we take your speaking in the podcast to be consent to speak in the podcast. So we're going to talk today about invertebrate minds, from spiders to octopuses. Even when we feel powerless as humans, we hold an extraordinary amount of power over animals in the world. And I don't just mean the power you have over your dog or the power your cat has over you. We hold extraordinary power over often overlooked animals like invertebrates, the ants whose civilization you just disrupted in your garden, or the spiders in your loft, the octopus in the sea. And we're going to talk today in this panel about the nature of those invertebrate minds and a bit about their welfare as well. There are Twitter hashtags for today's event. It's hashtag LSE Festival. Please, if you have forgotten like I often do, please put your phones on silent at this stage so we don't have any phone disruptions. The event is being recorded. And I'm very pleased today to be with a quite diverse group of panelists. I'm going to introduce you now. Let's see, so I'll start on all the way on the end is Jonathan Birch. He's a professor of philosophy, and he's the principal investigator on the Foundations of Animal Sentience Project, which played a key role in the UK government's recent Animal Sentience Bill. He's an expert on animal sentience, cognition, and welfare, but also in altruism and on social behavior, the latter of which you can read about in his 2017 book, called The Philosophy of Social Evolution. Ellie Leadbeater, she's a professor of biological sciences at the Royal Holloway and an expert on the ecology and evolution of social animals, but particularly bees. Her research group studies fundamental questions about communication and social behavior and conservation of social animals. Coming back now to Sam Beck-Bessinger. She's an author, author of the best-selling book, Manage Your Money Like a Fucking Grown-Up, and also has a new novel out called Girls of Little Hope that involves, indeed, I believe, the perspective of an invertebrate,
yes,
that is a tapeworm, so that you can buy now on shelves. She teaches creative writing at Bath Spa University, writes kids' TV and picture books, and once wrote for Marvel. And then finally, just next to me here is Daria Zakharova. She's a LSE philosophy PhD candidate working on biological and artificial minds. And interestingly, in 2023, she helped create an art installation called In Search of Spider Consciousness that invited people to enter the mind of a giant spider. And you may have seen there is here at the LSE Festival a VR showcase of the same animal mind, a spider mind, with a headset that you'll be able to see as you go out of this room a bit on your left in the same floor. You can do a virtual reality experience of this as part of the Displays of Power exhibition. And now we're going to get straight to it. We'll have about 25 to 30 minutes of discussion, and then we'll open it up to discussion from the audience, both here and in the online session. So thanks, everyone, again. So what sort of thing is an animal mind? I thought I'd start with Ellie. She's done some particular research on the nature of, well, minds in bees, but I thought maybe you could tell us a little bit about what it's like to be a bee. What kinds of sensations would I experience? What is the mind of a bee like?
Okay, so in terms of thinking about what a mind is, then I'm someone who likes to have a physical representation of something because it's too abstract to think about what a mind is, right? And so how a bee might think about things, but we can look at the brain. And we can look at kind of, we can compare bee brains or other invertebrate brains with each other and with human brains. And the one thing that we do know is that they evolved completely or almost completely separately. We don't know if it's completely separately, so evolution came up with the same solution twice, or maybe they started with the same kind of little net of neurons. But either way, the brain is very different in an invertebrate to a vertebrate, and even within the invertebrates, it's very different. So I don't think there's one question, there's one answer to how invertebrates perceive the world, because, for example, bees have very kind of they have very complex brains, and they have some of the same solutions to problems as we do. So they, you know, they learn about things, they remember things, they have inputs from their eyes and from their antennae. They can translate those into their responses. But that doesn't mean that that's they're doing it in the same way as a fly would, kind of thing. Yeah. So, but either way, they have come up with the same solutions, they learning and memory, but they've come up with it independently. So it might be that it's very, very different to you know, the way that we do it.
Were you going to comment, Jonathan?
Well, yes. Could you give us perhaps a sense of the diversity of insect cognition? Because I love bees as well. But to be fair, we do hear about bees a lot because they're perceived as these superstars of the insect cognition world.
Yeah.
But I don't know. There's a lot of insects out there, huge variation, very interesting cognitive mental lives in other insects as well.
Mm-hmm.
You want to give us your favorite examples?
Oh, I think it's flies. But actually, there are different types of insect brains, but the insects that have the most kind of complex developed brains are bees, cockroaches, and flies, and dragonflies as well, I think. So it's a little unfair to say that a fly is very different to a bee, but they are learning about all. I mean, they are our best model of memory. They are how we understand genes control memory, and a fly has kind of multiple, the same way as we do. We have short-term memory, we have medium-term memory, long-term memory. They're all different processes that actually, they're kind of different bins that you can put memories into. They don't lead into each other. And the same is true for a fly. So a fly can, sample a fruit and discover that's a great place to lay eggs, and it can put it into its short-term memory. Another species might put that same information into its long-term memory. It just depends what evolution has led it to.
I've totally changed the way that I see flies, to be honest, in that one very striking thing to me is the fact that they sleep, and not only do they sleep, but they have quiet and active sleep phases. Bruno van Swinderen's lab has been studying this, where, you know, just as we have REM sleep and we have slow wave sleep, and the REM sleep is associated with dreaming, you know, the flies too have these active sleep stages where, who knows, I mean, they could be dreaming. And then the other incredibly striking study I saw, this was from Michael Young, who's a Nobel Prize winner. His lab recently has been looking at how social isolation affects sleep. So they have these experiments where one of the fruit flies is on one side of a partition in like a test tube, and the rest of the social group is on the other side, and so they can see them but they can't interact with them, and it disrupts their sleep. Their sleep is disrupted. They also eat more, which is much the same pattern we saw in humans during lockdowns, where, you know, social isolation makes us stressed as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Actually, one of the things that I think is interesting about fly sleep is, again, that is shaped by different environments, right? So as far as I understand, different species, so desert species have siestas, for example, in the same way that, you know, that happens to humans in hot countries, right? Like, so it's just another example of what evolves kind of cognitively or physiologically fits your environment, right? It doesn't just go along one single axis towards being more complicated or more
the mind is always, it's always fitting the challenges posed by the environment.
Yeah, exactly.
So in the case of, well, taking a siesta, I imagine it's because it's too hot to expend too much energy, something like that. What is it that would make, say, short-term memory develop more in a species as compared to long-term memory?
Yeah, so, I mean, it is a question that we don't really know the answer to yet. Like, it's one of the things that we're looking at. But you can imagine that, say, to take the example of bees again, if you're in an environment that changes, so bees have to learn about flowers, right? They have to learn, for example, that lavender is in flower at the moment and they should focus on going to lavender. So if you store that in long-term memory, that's great as long as lavender stays in flower. But if it doesn't, or if you're missing kind of other potential things that you could sample and learn about, so the environment changes, then it might be better to store it in a short-term memory bin. And interestingly, short-term memory is a lot less costly in terms of energy. So we know that the same way as we get tired when we use our brains a lot, then we know that long-term memory involves more energy. So it might be a better idea to actually just store it in a short-term memory bin.
They need to forget, basically. Yeah. To be good foragers, they need to forget and learn what's new.
Yeah. Although, interestingly, we actually evolve forgetting as well. So it's not just a case of you put it in a short-term memory bin. When we form long-term memories, we also start to... There's an active process of erasing that starts at the same time. Right? Yeah. So it becomes very complicated.
Before we came onto the stage, we had a little pre-chat, and you were telling us something about how we have this model of cognition where more is always better and more like human is always better, but this kind of disrupts that idea. Can you say that again? Because I thought that was incredibly profound.
So... earlier in my career, I started off working on bees because I was interested in the fact that they seem to do so many human-like things. Over the course of time, I kind of became a little bit irritated by that because it kind of suggested that, you know, if they didn't do something that was human-like or if they did something else, it was in some way lower down the evolutionary scale or something. Whereas, in fact, of course, evolution doesn't have a kind of endpoint that it's going to. And that endpoint is humans. It's that it creates a mind which is well fitted to that particular environment. And sometimes it might be particularly good, or particularly memory might be particularly long term. And we think of long term as good, right? But as we've just said, long term isn't necessarily good. So it's about evolution proceeding among these very many different axes, rather than kind of going up a linear scale. Yeah.
So there's no single scale, you know.
Yeah,
when we talk about animals being, you know, more intelligent than others or more conscious than others, people sometimes say this isn't the reality.
Yes, exactly. Everything's fitted to its environment.
Jonathan, that does raise a related question that I understand your project has looked at a fair bit. So many of us associate our own minds with a conscious experience, but we're not always focusing on that when we deal with, well, a housefly. Now, there's a difference that's important to your project, I understand, between consciousness on the one hand and sentience on the other hand. Maybe I'd be interested if you could clarify for me, what's the state of evidence for sentience, your area of interest, regarding invertebrates like flies and bees?
I've been deliberately pushing the term sentience for the last 5 years with my Foundations of Animal Sentience project, because although we could say consciousness, and in fact, in the New York Declaration of Consciousness that we launched earlier this year, we did use that term, but I prefer sentience because I think it draws our attention to what I see as the most basic, most elemental, most evolutionarily ancient layer of our own consciousness, which is not the kind of reflective thought. It's not the inner monologue. It's the raw feelings, the subjective experiences of having senses, having emotions, feeling pleasure and pain. And that's what the term sentience is drawing our attention to. And we always wonder, you know, we wonder about other animals. What are they feeling? Are they sentient? We've often forgotten invertebrates in these discussions, at least until recently. But I think I've come around to the view that the sentient world is probably very, very large, and it includes many invertebrates as well as vertebrates, like fishes. And that means the vast majority of sentient beings are insects, if this view is correct, which is quite a shocking thing to take in, you know, quite a shocking thing to realize. And to a large extent, it is that fly evidence I was talking about and the bee evidence we've been describing that really pushes you to take this seriously, I think. But people used to dismiss insects as being reflex machines. The idea was we're familiar with reflexes in our own lives. You know, you touch a hot stove and it's not the pain that causes you to withdraw your hand. Your hand is already withdrawing before you feel any pain. And so there was this idea that, well, for insects, that's all they have. You know, all they have is just a bunch of reflexes. And this just isn't true. And by increments, we've realized how wrong that was. You know, we realized, first of all, that they They represent the world. They calculate the way back to the nest. They interpret each other's waggle dances. They learn incredibly well. They can learn novel tasks they've never had to meet in their lives, like string pulling. They can learn from each other. They can innovate. They can improve on what they've seen. They can have forms of culture almost, where particular ways of performing tasks get passed down the generations. And then people started to ask, what if their cognitive lives are so impressive? Do they have emotional lives as well? And again, it seems like the evidence is pointing in that direction. I was very struck by a study from last year suggesting some evidence of play in bees, where we know that bumblebees will roll balls to get reward, so that they'll roll the ball into a hole. It looks a bit like they're playing football. And so the twist on that was to ask, well, what about when there's no reward? There's just balls there for them to roll around if they want. And the bumblebees still do it, particularly the young ones, I think particularly male ones. And they just seem to be rolling these balls when they know there's no reward, as if just enjoying the process of playing and having fun, as it were. And so these are amazing creatures that we need to take seriously the realistic possibility that they're having feelings.
Can I just, on that, I mean, something that really struck me, when Jane Goodall started studying chimpanzees in the late 50s, early 60s, I read the story once where when she tried to publish her first piece of research about what she'd seen of the chimpanzees in Tanzania, in her draft, she'd referred to them with human pronouns, person pronouns. So yeah. She, he did this, she did this. And the editor went and corrected all of those pronouns to it did this, because for most of even the 20th century, our perception even of primates was that they're automatons, they're reflex creatures, they have behavior, but it's foolish to think that they have minds because they don't have souls. And we were still kind of haunted by that story, that metaphor of understanding even primate minds. And that was as recently as the 1960s. So, you know, we've kind of been on this journey, I think, over the past few decades of expanding our circle of maybe of empathy is kind of what I'm interested in as a storyteller, but also just our cultural awareness in Western thinking, I think, because this is something that we particularly have moved away from and are rediscovering almost. Yeah.
I mean, I'm trying to push against this as well. Yes, you're right. Yeah. There's absolutely this tendency going back to the behaviorist movement of the early 20th century to think that, well, if you're talking about consciousness or sentience or feeling, you're not doing science anymore. That really hard science has to be about something else, like behavior. And I don't think that's true. I mean, the grain of truth there is that we don't have conclusive evidence for subjective experience or feeling. And there is this tendency, I think, sometimes in science to think, well, If I don't have conclusive evidence, I'd better not talk about that at all. You know, this natural caution. But I think sometimes we have to push against that and say, well, actually, if you're giving people the impression that these creatures are reflex machines that feel nothing, that's very problematic, you know? And you've got to be willing to talk about a realistic possibility of conscious experience being there.
Can I ask... So I was thinking when you were talking about all the complicated things that that insects can do, and I was thinking, well, why does evolution actually need to add sentience to that as well? So if I can, you know, you study AI, right? If I can program an AI to do those things, which it could do all those things, right? What's the added benefit?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I don't myself think of sentience as something that is added in that way. I think that it is the activity of the brain. It is a kind of computation. I'm not sure about that, but I think there's quite a high chance of that being right. This idea that in philosophy it gets called materialism or physicalism. And if you have that view, there doesn't need to be something extra. You know? There doesn't need to be this magic extra thing. And then we face the question of why would you need the magic extra thing? The brain is already doing such a great job. But I think when we're talking about sentience, we are talking about a special kind of brain processing that does various functions for us relating to sophisticated forms of learning and behavioral control. And so that's why I think that when we see these similar sophisticated behaviors in insects, this is not conclusive evidence, but it's raising the probability. It should get us to take that possibility more seriously.
Mm-hmm. It came up earlier that there's surely a role in the way we tell stories about these sorts of animals and how we think of their experiences. And of course, there's a history of telling stories about insects, which is not all that empathetic. Mm-hmm. It's the sort of thing that we make jokes about when we say, you know, what's the last thing that goes through a fly's brain when it hits the windshield? And people say it's bum. And it's a sad thing, isn't it? It's not an empathetic thing. And more generally, we tell stories about using a magnifying glass to kill ants. Children do it. And so I wonder, you know, what is the role of storytelling and how we conceive of the experience of invertebrate animals? How does that relate to, you know, our empathy for animals more generally? And I know, having told a story, Sam, about a tapeworm recently, I wonder if you have any comments on that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think writing fiction, it's always an exercise in empathy. You're always trying to imagine the mind of a different, usually a different person to you. And that always requires some imagination. And with the novel, my tapeworm novel, and it's called Girls of Little Hope, and really it's a novel about the horror of puberty, which is kind of a very horrifying thing. But what we were interested in, me and my co-author Dale Halverson, was this question of how we become who we become, you know, and that process of forging an identity during puberty. And a lot of that is around memory, and a lot of that is around learning what is painful behavior. And that kind of got us to, in a very roundabout way, thinking about tapeworm minds and invertebrate minds, and thinking about these really kind of foundational activities that, you know, are how we form, how we become ourselves. And, you know, I decided, because it just seemed like a fun idea, to write some chapters in the novel from the perspective of this tapeworm character. And, you know, that was kind of a really fun creative challenge to ask what sensations will this creature have, which leads you to ask what perceiving organs does it have? But then that kind of leads you immediately to sort of higher order questions. So if that's kind of what it's perceiving, what could it be thinking, for want of a better word? And I think that as humans, we're so fundamentally storytelling animals, you know, and how we understand our own conscious experience is also narrativized. Like, I don't know that we are often talking very accurately about what our minds feel like. If we were to describe the moment-to-moment experience of our minds, it's also not this kind of self, this conscious identity. That's how we describe the experience of being human. And I don't think it's accurate always. So it was a really interesting kind of creative exercise. It was interesting to kind of then go and look at the history of other people who've written from the perspective of invertebrates. Most recently, the kind of very popular book in science fiction has been this book called Children of Time by Adrian Tchaikovsky. It's a fantastic novel, largely told from the perspective of the Portia spider. But kind of imagining how it might evolve a separate culture. But I think kind of one of, there's a lot of, in science fiction particularly, there's a number of books that think from the perspective of invertebrates. One of my favorites is actually the Ender's Game series, and it's an alien species. But to give a spoiler for a 40-year-old book, sorry. I think the twist of the book is that, you know, the human race is being attacked by, they're called bugs or buggers, this alien race that are very insectoid. And at the end of the book, the hero kills them all, saves the human race, only to realize that they were incredibly intelligent, and learns as well that the reason that the bugs had been trying to kill the human race is because they assumed we weren't. They assumed we were automatons. And I think in this time, all where there is kind of massive species destruction, when we're having such an impact on the planet, this question of how far our empathy can extend feels very urgent to me.
Daria, as another person who's struggled with how to represent what's happening in the mind of a of invertebrates. Could you tell us a little bit about your perspective on this sort of thing, how the art exhibit went and how you thought about how to get inside the mind of a spider?
Yeah, thank you. Well, first of all, I'm very happy to have been given the chance to bring this installation to the LSE. I invite everyone to try it out, to try the VR version of it afterwards. I promise it's not a scary spider. It's a toy spider. Yeah. It has been modeled after a particular spider, called Portia. So I generally just think that art and immersive art in particular can be an amazing medium for us to help imagine other minds, to think about other minds, to understand them, and ultimately to extend our empathy towards them. And I was just thinking that part of what when we speak of empathy, what it implies is this ability to imagine what someone else might feel like, to have an idea of what it's like to be in someone else's shoes or someone else's head, basically. And it's interesting because it relates in a way to the problem we have in thinking about consciousness of other beings. When we talk about someone being conscious, we think, well, to be conscious means something like there's some kind of subjective experience. There's something what it's like to feel, to be that creature. And the problem is that we cannot literally look into someone else's head. And what we did with our installation is to play with this idea, to play with this problem, and to make people literally physically walk into a giant spider's head and to see, to experience what it's like to be in there. And I also think that it's kind of appropriate that while we were trying to make the experience very immersive with creative coded lights and music that was specifically composed for that. It was supposed to put you in some state of kind of a almost a trance-like, and you would spend some time in there. And at the same time, it does not explain to you and does not give you a manual of what exactly is going on. It doesn't tell you things like, this is how a spider mind works. This is what its consciousness is like. Because we are aware that minds of invertebrates or a mind of a spider could work in such different ways from us. We could still expend our empathy towards that creature, even not completely understanding what the experiences are like. So that was kind of the idea. And then based on some recent research, we did kind of an artistic interpretation of what it could be like inside of the spider's head.
And originally this was a real sculpture, like a huge metal sculpture about 10 meters across.
Yes, I should add, yes, it was a giant sculpture that we built, that I built with an amazingly talented team, interdisciplinary team of people. We built it in Spain a year ago. It was 3.5 meters tall and 10 to 12 meters in length. And it would be, you would just like walk up to this giant spider, and then if you would walk around it, you would discover an opening. And then you would go inside and find yourself in a short, dark corridor kind of space until you land inside of the head, so to say, in front of the two giant eyes in which you would see lights and experience music, and you could spend time in there, so to say, discovering.
Yeah. And we asked the LSE, could we reassemble this 10 by 3 meter spider on the campus? And they said, we don't have space for such a thing.
Yeah.
But I mean, absolutely love your ingenuity in then saying, well, in that case, I'll make a VR experience that recreates, you know, transports you to the Spanish desert and puts you in the place of climbing into the giant wooden spider.
Yeah, you could. The VR is also an amazing tool. VR art is a bit niche, I think, still, but like very interesting. It makes the kind of the immersive bit of the experience all new.
And can I ask, how did you decide how the spider is it based on how the spider would see the world and smell the world and things? Or right, okay, so that is the sensory experience.
It's a sensory experience, exactly. So I should say that the inspiration, so this experience is centered mostly around the spider's eyes. This particular spider has incredibly good vision, which is quite unique among other spiders. Most spiders are actually pretty blind despite having 8 eyes. I don't know what happened there, maybe. But this particular spider can see incredibly well with its 2 big eyes.
Like tubes.
Exactly. They're built like a looking glass. So it's two long tubes. It's not like a compound eye of many other other invertebrate insects, mostly. So it's tubes, and the tubes are moving in particular patterns. When the spider inspects its surroundings, it performs this particular behavior called scanning, where it turns its head and the tubes are moving in like specific patterns until they fixate on an object, and then they start scanning the object, and the looking glass is moving around constantly. The idea was basically, some of Jonathan's work was about that, about dimensions of consciousness. So rather than talking about how different animals could be more or less conscious than some other animal, we should look at how rich particular experiences could be, and that would depend on perceptual modalities that they have, for example. So an elephant that has incredibly good memory, if we try to imagine what kind of experiences it might have, having a great memory would add to the richness of the experience along that in that dimension, while it doesn't have really good vision at all. So we don't think this is going to be a very rich conscious experiences, if at all. And then with these particular spiders, it's the other way around. We don't know much about their memory. There's some evidence they have working memory. People disagree about that. But what we do know is that it has this incredibly good vision and does a lot of processing with those eyes while having a very, very tiny brain. So we were inspired by that and then took the whole experience to be around the eyes and around the light patterns that move in those eyes and about the vision.
I'm really interested also about the fact that you study AI as well, because, you know, you were talking about the different perceptual abilities of different animals, which is a kind of very embodied fundamental question. And, you know, I think there's this really interesting thing, you know, talking about the chimpanzee thing, about how historically humans have differentiated ourselves and said we're different to all the other animals because we can think, we have these higher order reasoning abilities. And now as AI is increasingly able to do those things better than we can in many dimensions, increasingly we talk about, but we're different because we're physical, and that makes us different to AIs, you know, that makes our consciousness different to their consciousness. So as someone who's kind of straddling both of those worlds in your research, like, how are you thinking at the moment about that question?
It's hard. Also because AI is developing so fast currently, and it's really tricky to talk about what AI cannot do currently, because 2 weeks later you might be. Yeah, I'm definitely interested. I've been interested for a long time interested in the biologically inspired approach to thinking about the mind, including the artificial minds. And I was interested in questions like, maybe there's something about how biological agents interact with the environment that we do need to necessarily recreate in AI. In principle, it's not that we could have a simulated agent. It doesn't have to be a physical robot or anything like that. But there's something interesting about how biological agents interact with the world that shapes their minds. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I also am very open to the view that the developments in AI and our evolving evidence in other animal minds just shows how you can realize things like intelligence and maybe even consciousness in different ways. Maybe there is just not a single mechanism. And I think that's it's an interesting bit about studying both animals and AI. I feel like those fields can actually inform each other a lot, or at least inspire being open to different approaches of thinking about intelligence.
Which is a great idea, yeah. I think we're living through a big challenge to that Cartesian human exceptionalism that you were describing, Sam, where Descartes was very skeptical of subjective experience in other animals, but then had this view that language is the only certain sign of thought hidden in a body. He said, you know, language is the gold standard, you know, the only real marker. And I think that's just been completely exploded. You know, what we've learned in the past couple of years is that language is surprisingly easy to achieve computationally. It's not as difficult a challenge as we thought in some ways. And it's changing the way people think about consciousness, because that last stronghold of human exceptionalism, that one thing we can point to and say, oh, look, we're special because we've got this thing. Mm. Maybe that's the only real evidence of consciousness, etc. Mm. That's just been completely exploded. So I think it is absolutely causing people to turn back to the body, turn back to the brain, think about what is it really that is making us conscious, and people increasingly starting to see that whatever it is, it's very probably something we share with a lot of other animals.
It's interesting because I think also it's this question of, is consciousness kind of a binary? You either have it or you don't have it. And what I found really interesting as a layperson to this field when I first encountered your research was the idea of potentially what we talk of as consciousness as one thing might be referring to an umbrella of different things. Is that a view, not your view?
It's like, I sort of think there is some unity there in that we're talking about subjective experience. That there's got to be something it feels like from the point of view of the animal. So there has to be that point of view there. But then that could be all it is that the different forms of consciousness have in common. And on every other dimension could be just variation everywhere. And I don't think that variation leads to a sliding scale, just like Ali was saying earlier about cognition. So I don't think your dog is more conscious than your cat. You know, I don't think that claim makes any sense. What I think is we've got lots and lots of forms of consciousness, a huge world of these forms. They vary along many, many different dimensions.
What you're saying, Jonathan, about kind of the idea of language being the unique marker disappearing, in a way it made me think about the fact that actually with AI, in some way, I think we're getting further from understanding what consciousness is, right? Because we're showing that actually you can pretty much almost program something to be a human, behave like a human, make all the decisions that a human could. Not yet, right? But we might get there. But we still kind of know that that thing is not conscious. We assume that because we've programmed it and we didn't put something in there.
I guess I don't assume that. I'm not 100% sure.
You think it would emerge,
But I think it's right to say that about current AI that it's very, very unlikely to be conscious. Mm. And it's pushing us to really think about why that is. I mean, to me, it has to do with time in a way. Our conscious experience is this stream that extends across time, one moment flowing into the next. Mm. And we know that sort of continuity across time is not there in large language models, that each interaction is this completely new thing. Mm. Essentially, the slate is completely wiped. You begin again. The context window, as they call it, can be very long. So the conversation can get very long. But it's always that snapshot, that single moment interaction. And I think that kind of system is very, very unlikely to be conscious. But I don't talk about certainty. You know, I don't say I'm sure, because I think that would be a mistake. I think we might come to a point where we do create conscious AI systems, and we need to be willing to accept that. We need to be willing to err on the side of caution when that happens, and not be confidently dismissing the sentience of these systems for decades while we torture them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm aware there may be, I'm not certain, but there may be some conscious systems in the room or online who might wish to get into the debate or ask a question. So if anybody does have a question, please feel free to raise your hand, and we'll take a few from the room and then go to the online audience.
Please wait for the microphone.
Yeah, if you would please wait for the microphone and speak into it so everyone can hear you.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Firstly, thank you for your discussion. Really interesting topic. And I was wondering what your thoughts were about the role that communication plays in mediating, obviously, our conscious experience, because really, communication is a reflection of how we modulate the processing of information through our, like, you know, cognitive mechanisms. And kind of tying it back to, like, some of the points that were raised around language and storytelling, it's very evident that the development of consciousness in humans is very socially dependent and constructed. And so it seems also that we need to move away from this very insular definition or, like, perspective of consciousness. Like we really view consciousness as this like singular phenomena, like from every instance of a species. On the topic of AI, it's interesting also how we what large language models can do is that they detect patterns in language, and they really reflect the syntax of, you know, human language, not necessarily the semantics. Like these AI models don't really understand what they're saying to us, but they know that statistically speaking, if they arrange these words together, they'll make something comprehensible. And then connecting it back to invertebrates, for example, like when we think about ants and colonies and the way that they communicate with each other and collectively exhibit these behaviors, because through behaviors is the only way that we actually get to communicate with these animals, as a proxy for the lack of information and the lack of communication that they can present to us. Interestingly enough, actually, earlier today I came across an article, and it said how they used AI to analyze the communication patterns of elephants, and from that they found actually that elephants use names for each other. So as a sort of adage to that question, what sort of communication channels potentially could we use AI to analyze within invertebrates or other like animals, which could maybe give us more of an insight into whether they do have these sort of like conscious modes of expression? Thank you.
I mean,
right, anyone like to comment on that?
There are projects underway of that type, as you say. There's this project called the Earth Species Project that is very actively trying to use AI to decode animal communication. Mm-hmm. I find it very, very hard to assess how likely that is to succeed. I admit I'm someone who thought with the early chatbots like GPT-1 and GPT-2, this is going absolutely nowhere. this is absolutely rubbish technology, and was completely wrong about that. And so I feel a little bit skeptical about the idea of decoding animal communication, but I could be proved wrong. Mm. It's good to be having a conversation about the sort of ethical implications about that and what it would mean.
Sorry. So someone was telling me once about having gotten some interesting results from using AI to decode, I think, baboon communication, in terms of like having figured out more, I don't know, different categories of behavior than the researchers have previously predicted. Just because, yeah, I don't know, maybe AI picks on things that we don't know about. In that way, I mean, I don't think it has shown much yet.
Wonderful about wonderful at detecting patterns. Yes. You know, if anyone's listening to the podcast, get a transcript and just ask GPT-4 or Claude to give you a summary. Give you a wonderful summary of what we've just been saying. Mm. So that summarizing ability is absolutely fantastic. So in cases where we've got a lot of data, which is sometimes true, because when you've got automated recording, automated tagging of animal movements, where you've got a lot of data, the AI will find patterns in that data, which is the great strength of it. Often, you know, what I fear sometimes with the animal case is that we often don't have as much data as we want. You know, we actually haven't recorded enough of them communicating, and that the limitation is in the data rather than in the analysis.
In some ways, the communication debate for me, you can have complex communication, and ants do have complex communication, although they can't distinguish between individuals and things like that. But you know, even if they could, to me, that's taking a trait that humans have. Complex communication and consciousness, and saying, oh, well, ants have complex communication, therefore somehow they also have consciousness. The fact that the AI could do the complex communication and the evolution, you could get an evolutionary AI that would produce that, right? Doesn't convince me that they're conscious. I'm coming across as a big consciousness skeptic and ambivalent on that. I think it's hard to find the evidence. But
I think you're right in that case. In a way, this is what AI is showing us. You're right not to think that complex communication and signaling by itself is evidence of consciousness, particularly not when the code might be pre-programmed, as seems to be the case with the waggle dance, for example, which is absolutely amazing, fantastic, and it leads people in the right direction because it gets people to take bees more seriously. Mm-hmm. Right? But I don't think it in itself it's evidence of consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you'd kind of maybe be looking for a collection of potential markers, and then assess how certain you can be whether something would raise your certainty instead of looking at one behavior and saying, well, communication, for example, we think that's important for consciousness, and that's it.
That's Jonathan's probably got more to say on that than me, but in terms of actual saying what would be evidence of consciousness, yes, we can show evidence of human-like things, but again, for me, the step isn't there. That doesn't mean that I kind of by default think there is no consciousness. And I'd rather treat them as though there was, because it's, you know, I don't want to have tortured things that were conscious. But yeah, I still haven't found something that's a perfect step. But then I know that you've come across a lot of paradigms that may show that.
I think that, I mean, that erring on the side of caution thought is absolutely right. And I mean, my book, The Edge of Sentience, the subtitle is Risk and Precaution in Humans, Other Animals and AI. Mm. It's coming out this August. And that idea that we need to be thinking about these issues in a precautionary way is absolutely right, I think. At the same time, yeah, I do think there is evidence in the insect case. What I don't think is that you ever get a gold standard test, a crucial experiment, that there's no single marker. You know, it was wrong to hold up language as that, but actually it's wrong to hold up anything as that. What we have to do is look for a very wide range of markers that we have some reason to think are relevant to consciousness because we see the link in us, and study the whole picture, look for the whole picture and make tentative inferences to the best explanation from that picture.
Okay, we'll take a few more questions. Yes, here in the front.
Thanks for the talk. I guess I'm wondering about what you all think of the connection between intelligence and sentience, like if there's this sort of difficulty when we're designing and interpreting studies that we might end up sort of conflating the two. And just, I guess, coming from this perspective of thinking like, oh, we have these very intelligent creatures, they must be more sentient. And so I guess what you all would think of about this connection. Thanks.
Well, I mean, in the book, I suggest that these things are, well, they're conceptually distinct. Intelligence is not sentience. In fact, the ideas are completely different. You could easily imagine them coming apart. I think in current AI, we do see them coming apart. Mm-hmm. And they're methodologically linked, because when an animal is intelligent, gives us more ways in which we can probe the question of its sentience. There's more experiments we can do. And we see this with bees, octopuses. The fact that they're intelligent, it leads to experiments like the play experiments and the ball rolling and the experiments on pain markers. It requires the ability to grasp the situation, the task. So it requires a certain level of intelligence. And because they have that, they can then give us this evidence of their sentience. So that means I worry about animals like snails, for example, where they might not be setting the world alight with their intelligence. That might limit the way in which we can look for markers of sentience in those animals.
Mm. This is important to ask why we're asking those questions as well, right? Like where it's connected to a very pragmatic question about how we're exploiting and how we're treating non-human animals. I think those questions are very, very relevant. But I think, you know, there's also kind of one thing I will say is that I think we overestimate how sentient human behavior is all the time. As a novelist who spends a lot of time thinking about why do humans do what we do, most of the time we're not aware even of how we're behaving. So I think it's also important to say to some extent we can decouple in some situations that question of sentience, intelligence, and how much it's okay to exploit or harm other creatures. And I think it's important, like there's really interesting definitional questions that we're pushing up against and all these new frontiers, but when we're asking the question, is it okay, how should we treat the animals that we have control and power over?
Yeah.
I think it's important to ask that question very directly and not necessarily first we have to figure out this very abstract question of what consciousness is.
It's good to bring it back to power, you know, our theme, in that people often say, well, what can we do about insects? Maybe they're sentient, but there's absolutely nothing we can do about that. And this really isn't true. We have immense power in this area. If you think about insect farming, literally trillions of insects being farmed in this very rapidly growing industry, so that they can be ground up and fed to fish usually. And we have a lot of power there. We have the power to treat these animals as if they felt nothing. And we have the power to err on the side of caution, try to develop some welfare guidelines. And obviously, I support the second thing.
Yeah, I find that context really helpful, that we're not necessarily, when we reflect on welfare of invertebrates, you know, admonishing you for killing a fly in the kitchen, but these sort of, you know, trillions of animals in an industry is a sort of different matter, and whether we can formulate good welfare policies in that context is a question we could all look
because,
at.
Because they're so small, you very quickly get to a situation where the vast majority of farmed animals globally are insects, just because of their size.
Remarkable.
And you know, that's a big, big industry, very poorly regulated.
Well, if we may, perhaps we'll turn to an online question.
I can give two questions from our online audience. The first one is from an anonymous participant who is interested in finding out more about the cognition and perception of spiders specifically. The second question from Sophia in Fez, Morocco, asks, I'm interested in your thoughts on Walter Veit's concept of pathological complexity. He proposes that consciousness evolved as an adaptive response to complex health challenges from active animal lifestyles at a multicellular level, marking a significant evolutionary transition in agency. Do you think this idea effectively summarizes your discussion on whether invertebrate minds are conscious?
The first question really is for you, Dorian.
I'll take the first one, yeah. So I can talk a little bit about Porsche spiders. I'm actually really not an expert on any other spiders. So Porsche is a very interesting case because these spiders have fascinated researchers for decades because of their very sophisticated looking hunting behavior. So these spiders hunt other spiders, often spiders that are bigger than themselves. And what they do is that they, because of how good their vision is and their behavior is visually guided, which is very unique again among spiders, what they do is when they detect the prey from afar, seem to spend a bunch of time looking around, assessing the scene, it seems like, and then they do a detour behavior where they walk away from the prey, walk into a different direction, lose the prey from its sight, do a detour until they position themselves from where they can attack, and then they jump onto the prey. And this behavior is really interesting because it seems like these spiders are planning, as if they are able to simulate the scenario in their head. They always choose the correct way to the prey. They kind of don't seem to get lost very often, seems like at least. This provoked kind of those questions of like, what are the cognitive abilities of those tiny, tiny creatures? And their brains are so small. They have something like 60,000 neurons. For comparison, a bee's brain has 1,000,000. So it's like a much smaller brain, a much more simple, let's say. And there were rivaling explanations of what's going on in these spiders. And that whole thinking about that has kind of inspired both the installation and then some.
Surely inspired the Children of Time novel as well.
Probably, yeah.
One of my complaints about that book is that Adrian Tchaikovsky has this drug or something that makes the spiders grow incredibly large.
Oh yeah.
Makes them more human-like. Mm-hmm. But I love the idea of, you know, something absolutely minuscule can still display these incredible feats of intelligence.
Yeah.
It's just absolutely phenomenal. Yeah, you give it choice between two paths, one of them with a gap in it that it will fall through if it takes that one, and the other one complete. Basically, they always scan the scene and then they choose the complete path, the unbroken path.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's absolutely unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. Yeah, I guess to me, the interesting kind of bit of the debate here is whether we have to posit something like a mammal-like simulation ability in these spiders.
Yeah.
And then we face the problem of the brain being very small. But then people are like, well, do we know exactly how many neurons do you need?
It very much seems like they're planning, right?
It seems like they're planning, right? So this is one hypothesis, that we underestimate what a small brain can do in terms of some kind of simulation and planning. Mm. And then there's another hypothesis that says you don't need that. You can produce a very complex behavior with a simple mechanism, and there are different ways to solve a particular task. And you don't need anything like mammal-like planning ability. And then you can bet on something like, well, these creatures are so distant from mammals, why would they have a similar cognitive model of how they deal with particular situations? Mm-hmm. Their niche is completely different, the ecological niche, the pressures they had to face are really different. That kind of connects to your work. And we really do not have any kind of conclusive evidence there, but we're trying to figure out what the better explanation would be, and maybe we need to do more experiments, etc. So this kind of ongoing debate is what I can say on the spiders' minds in particular. But what we do know is that their eyes are really, truly fascinating. There was another one.
Well, I mean, there's the question about the evolution of consciousness, yeah, where inevitably all theories in this area are speculative, of course, because we're talking about events that may have been 600 million years in the past. It's very hard to make solid inferences about that. The theories are extremely interesting. I've very much enjoyed Peter Godfrey-Smith's books, Other Minds and Metazoa, which gives you one kind of evolutionary narrative. Also very much enjoyed Eva Jablonka, Simona Ginsberg's book, The Evolution of the Sensitive Soul, that gives a quite different narrative in which learning plays an incredibly important role, and consciousness has this function related to learning. And then Walter gives a kind of third evolutionary narrative. And yeah, I see some value in constructing these narratives just to give us pictures of how consciousness might fit in to evolution. But I don't think we're in a position to really confidently choose between these different stories.
Well, we're just about out of time. I mean, I do find it remarkable anytime I have the feeling that there's somebody else who has a mind which is in some way like my own. It just fills you with a sense of wonder. And so I hope you might go away and have that feeling maybe about a housefly or an ant or something that you're not as used to having the experience with. Thank you so much for coming to both audiences and to the speakers. Thank you ever so much.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.